All right, so we should be back. Let me see if that actually worked. Let's see. Can you guys hear us? Can you see us? Let me reset the stream here. Man, we may have to. Okay. I think we're back. Yeah, I think we're back. Can you guys hear us? It says we're live. I don't know if we are or not, but it says we're live.
Oh, I can hear you.
Yeah, you. I can hear you too. You're great right now. Hey, we're back. Said we were live for like, we were having a conversation for 10 minutes and we weren't live. I love this program. Ah. So I think we left off at the 45 minute mark, and we're going to have to go back and talk about everything we just talked about. So I'll just encapsulate it and give you the cliff notes. When we came back to the quasi live show that we thought was live that wasn't live, we were talking about carriers are missile sponges. They were created in World War II. They haven't really been updated since World War II. Cyber's now a factor. And oh, by the way, if you open up tech in the mail, you should check it for bombs. Did I miss anything?
No, I think you got it. I think what everybody needs to acquaint themselves with is that all of these exquisite platforms that I think it's the end of manned combat aviation. I think it's the end of manned fighting vehicles. I think it's the end of manned tanks. I certainly think it's the end of surface navies. Because what we have is we have the U.S. Navy making this claim in the Red Sea after they turn tail and run three times, where they say it was the most intense naval combat, paraphrasing, the most intense naval combat since World War II, against a foe that did not have a navy. The latest craft they had, Russian missile boats that were manufactured before 1975, and they even took, and I'm not a naval guy, to play with them, but I look at a map of the Red Sea, I would never take a carrier up the flat and have that carrier there. That's not what those are designed for. Maneuvering, sea room. Now, maybe the reason they do that is so that when it sinks, it will sink in shallow enough water where salvageability will be in the Pacific, where it would sink in 16,000 feet and be absolutely unsalvageable. I don't know. I don't want to get in the mind of modern admirals trying to be rake stompers and just military incompetence of the highest degree. I think the future of navies is going to be subsurface warfare, whether it's going to be subsurface robotics or submarines. Whatever the case may be, I'd always thought, Steve, that when it came to the littoral combat ship, the LC crappy ship, that has been such a disaster, wouldn't it have been nice to get in a time machine, step back, and you and I somehow have an influence where we convince the U.S. Navy to say the perfect littoral combat craft is a Type 214 German diesel electric submarine. The electrics, you should see the technology. Quieter than nukes for a variety of reasons. They don't have the loiter, the long-term loiter does, but when it comes to fast attacks or thorough combat, they don't necessarily need to be there for that. But what would the Navy have looked like if they had a martial imagination and they had actually done their homework for their concepts of operation, concepts of employment on what they were going to? I just think we have a very unserious flag officer corps across the board. And one thing that I did mention, which is not going to find grace with some, is in one of my episodes, I said we need to get rid of the United States Marine Corps. Now, I've never been in the Corps. My son, my only child, to go to the Corps, spent 4 years in Uncle Sam's misguided children. It was the boot to ask, so it was great for him. It was a great experience, as are all military experiences for the most part for young men, but we don't need the Corps anymore, especially when General Berger, the commandant of the Corps before this malefactor, who was currently the commandant, who claimed that there was no deep Corps, and they issued a memorandum stopping deep Corps. But But nonetheless, General Berger said, you know, we're going to take the Marine Corps, we're going to take away our force. So what we're going to do is we are going to create a Marine Corps that is regionally specific with what's called a stand-in force. We're on the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th island chains. We are going to secret and stealthily put Marines with missile batteries on those islands so that they can take pot shots at Chinese targets on the ocean. I just wonder, what are you thinking, and why would you even contemplate that? Because, for instance, Steve, imagine, how do you do combat search and rescue if the Marines are there stealthily? Well, you don't. How do you do it in peacetime? We don't have the means unless it's rotary wing, because we don't have seaplanes like that glorious US-2 that the Japanese have. We don't have any of those things. I find the carelessness and just the wacky lack of thought across the board with all of our flag officers and all of our DA and DOD and Department of the Navy civilians, they seem completely bereft of how history has passed them by. They're whistling past the graveyard, as you're saying, because what they're doing is they're fighting the last war, as is common among many warriors in history, but they're not paying attention to these changes on the battlefield, and they're not going to benefit from that when it comes to the next fight that we're going to have. For instance,
I don't blame that on DEI, Bill. I don't blame that on DEI at all. That is just, that is this belief system that we're still superior. China is not a blue water navy, and blue water navies are going to be around no matter what forever. And we just haven't moved away from that. I'm going to go back a little bit because I want to talk about, because you mentioned the Corps, right?
And yeah,
you talked about regional forces. Isn't that what a MEF is for? Isn't a Marine Expeditionary Force a regional force? Isn't that the whole point of a MEF?
It is.
Isn't that why you have 2 MEF and 3 MEF and 1 MEF? Because they're regional forces. And then you plus them up depending on the contingency. Why would you operate them in stealth mode when you could operate them above board? That's why you have special operation forces, is to park those guys to do, you know, hit and run operations and real guerrilla warfare versus, you know, park a MEF out there. That's not how that game's played. But it shows the level of archaic thinking across the board, right? And it's I was bringing up cyber for a reason, because it's just one facet of this new digital battle space that they've completely missed the mark on. I mean, I can remember watching the Chinese, the Russians, and just about everybody else breaking into our networks and talking to general officers, especially 2-stars, and saying, they're in our networks right now. They're not coming in tomorrow. They're here now, and they're exfiltrating data right now. And this is pretty important stuff. These are con plans. These are operations plans. These are not just, you know, run-of-the-mill specs on different weapon systems. They're stealing that too, but they're really full court stealing our operations plans. They know what we're going to do, which means we need to get them out of our networks, rewrite these plans, and figure out what they took. And the problem is, most of the general officers have never read it. Most of them, I can't say all of them, most of the general officers that I worked had never read a con plan or an O plan. Most of them had never written a con plan or O plan, so they had no idea what was in the plan. I'm sure all of them thought that they were just going to read the con plan or the O plan once the contingency kicked off. And that's what got us into problems in World War II, was the fact that we had been completely missing the mark on tank warfare that was going on in Europe at the same time we were trying to figure out if we needed tanks. And they were still infantry support, but here we are, right? And this is the same situation as we were in the 30s. We're on the cusp of a major global conflict, regardless of what anybody says. We're on the cusp of a conflict. Part of it's going to be economic. Part of it's going to be information. Part of it's going to be kinetic. The part that we're woefully missing is the information and kinetic parts. We don't have any of that mapped out in any coherent strategy.
So I have a suggestion that's going to make you even more nervous, unless you know this already. So we have a Minuteman 3, and I did an episode on this in Fixing Fight Club. I think it was 6, where I talked about escalation, salvo competition, escalation dominance, and where I also talked about nuclear weapon systems. I think the time of siloed land-borne missile forces is over. Now we have the Minuteman III. You probably know this, Steve. For the longest time, we used 8-inch floppy disks for command changes. No,
we didn't. Dude, we had plated wire memory in Minuteman I and Minuteman II all the way into the 90s.
So
we didn't do floppy disks and hard drives until the new React consoles came out in 92.
Those lasted until 2019. But here's what's scary. As anachronistic as 8-inch floppies sound, and I think there's a certain genius to adopting 8-inch floppies and even the prior technology you were just talking about, because not everybody has access to those or the readers for them. What they've done is they've gone to the internet with the command instructions. And I think that's a disaster because it speaks to precisely what you're saying. There is such a Sovietized, centralized, and dare I say, Ottoman-Hungarian turn of the 20th century general staff mentality in the Pentagon right now that everything has to be centralized. And all it's going to take, if they send, and they've centralized so much, all it's going to take is a back door that's opened or left open or somehow a malefactor gets in there. And then if everything is centralized, that means that you have centralized the levers of control for people who get in there and do bad things to the command and control, the C4I, all of those kind of things. You know, it's just, it's a disaster. And it's the only color on the rose in my mind that puts a good color on us not having fire synchronization in the U.S. Army and all of the forces. For those who aren't aware of it, I did an entire episode on this. The Russians have broken the code on fire synchronization with the Russian Strike Fire Reconnaissance Complex. In 2008 and 2010, during the renaissance of the Russian Armed Forces, what they said being an artillery-centric organization instead of air-centric, as the West, and especially the U.S. is they said, we want metal on target in under a minute, and we want it webbed so that in depth and width, whatever is the closest with the mostest, we will be able to assign fires to that cannon or whatever the mechanism is that's being used, and we'll be able to put metal on target in a minute. We don't have that. ABMS, they're still struggling with the air battle management system. They're still struggling with JADC2. They're still struggling with so many of these synchronization problems that we have, not only simply in the Army, but the joint forces talking to each other. And imagine, and I know we have members of the audience who have been there, when you fight with NATO forces, now numbering, I think, 32 instead of 11, different languages, different constructs, there is interoperability, but what's that fire synchronization going to be like? I knew on the ground in Afghanistan how bad that fire synchronization was in a very minor campaign scenario there. The only consistent fire synchronization that we had that worked was our CTT guys, those Air Force strongmen who I have the greatest respect for, who have 140-pound packs with all their comms, who are combat air controllers, who bring in that line of B-52s and F-18s and F-35s and AC-130s and such, and direct them to bring the hate on specified targets. We sort of got that synchronized, but that does not fit the campaigns that we're going to have in a peer conflict in which we are operating against a peer competitor like Russia.
Well, what do you do in an air environment where you have, you know, 1,000 drones going after 12 aircraft that are just as fast, just as capable, and cheaper to manufacture?
Yeah.
That high threat environment is to me is doubled in threat, because you could send autonomous drones out after aircraft, you wouldn't even know it hit you. There'd be no signals emanating from it unless you saw it. It's like it was like a missile in the 60s. Unless you got a chance to see it on the way up, you could avoid it. If you didn't see it, you were dead.
Yes,
or worse, absolutely captured. And it's the same thing now. The only difference is they can send 1,000 drones after you and your little 12 aircraft, you know, stick. And guess what? You're all swimming.
And Steve, you're so right. You're so right, because it's a war of leakers. You can have the most robust integrated air missile defense system, IAMD, system in place, but will you get everything? Remember what I discussed earlier about probabilities of kill. There's not a one-to-one exchange when it comes to intercepting inbound missiles. Sometimes you'll have to send 2, 3, or 4 of them. Are you going to do shoot, look, shoot? Are you going to do shoot, shoot, look? Whatever the targeting modalities and methodologies that you're going to employ, I suspect, because I'm not privy to all of this, that the Air Force has done their homework on this. Maybe the Army's done their homework on this, where they can do it. But nonetheless, I don't think they have their arms around it. For instance, if we go back to last year, when Iran launched all those salvos of drones and such against Israel, here is my suspicion. And all I'm going on is anecdotal evidence and a logic train that I put together. If I were the Iranian general staff in that time, before they sent their first salvos against Israel, I would have gone to all of my ammunition supply points and all my missile storage facilities, and I would have had my clipboard in hand. I would have said, I need all the oldest lot numbers of what we have. I don't care how rickety it is. Just give it to me. Give me 500 of them. 500 of our oldest missiles that we have. Send them aloft. Send them to Israel. And what you're doing is you're taking notes. You're looking at response times. You're looking at TTP. You're looking at locations. You're looking at where they are. You're looking at missile densities and things like that. It is a reconnaissance by fire that allowed them to successfully template a follow-on attack against Israel that will defeat the Iron Dome.
I have a lot of thoughts on that, but you're right. Short answer is, yeah, you're right. It's just a matter of how much they send after it to defeat it and overwhelm it, right? But where I'm stuck at, and this is why I have so many thoughts on it, is how many thousands of dollars do we spend on missiles versus how many hundreds of dollars are they spending on a drone? That model is not sustainable economically. There has to be, and I'm going to contend to you something that's going to make you laugh, but it's probably going to be true, that we will ultimately get back to flak weapons to defeat drones at low level, because it's the cheapest way to go.
You're singing my song. You're singing my song. But you know, where are the Ehrlichs and Bofors 20, 30, 40, 50 millimeter weapon systems that we saw on the picket ships off of the coast of Okinawa in April and May in 1945? Walls of steel. You should look at some of the footage.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing the ordnance they put in the air. And so I agree with you, Steve.
I mean, these will be automated systems, though. These won't be, you know, they'll be quad mounted miniguns. They'll be quad mounted Bofors that have ammo belts that you have thousands of rounds. Because those, let's face it, those rounds are cheaper to manufacture than missiles.
Absolutely. And but look how much it costs to manufacture anything for the military in the United States. I am so looking forward to the DOGE accounting and forensic investigation of the Pentagon. And they are going to go kicking and screaming into that. And they're going to put up all kinds of classified firewalls. But I'm hoping that they can kick some of those down, because I know that people have been astonished over the decades at the idea of $3,500 toilet seats. And I think a soap dispenser at $1,500 and such. Now, there's one reasonable reason for that, and that's this. The U.S. acquisition system is based on not trusting American contractors. That's the whole system's based on that. It's also based on a Soviet-style system for acquisition. But it's also based on a system where there's no expectation in the investment horizon for these companies to think that, well, I'm gonna make 50 widgets, but I have no idea, because of the flakiness of the acquisition system, whether I'll be able to have that contract for years on end. So they'll charge a lot at the beginning. For instance, if you build a new IFV or tank and you come to me as the contractor, you say, hey, Bill, I need the following tank, like the Bradley disaster in the 1980s, and I need it to do all of these things as an infantry fighting vehicle. Well, guess what? Your first one that you receive will be $50 million. And each additional one will be $2 or $3 million. When you have me pay, when I charge you $11 for a bolt, I'm doing that because I don't have consistent lights on at my factory because you're on again, off again, and your request for these parts. I mean, this cavalcade of calamities, this chaos avalanche in the acquisition system gives us these manifest failures since the 1980s and the 1990s in the naval ships that you and I talked about, the Bradley in the 1980s, talk of an electric M1 Abrams, which is fantastically stupid for a variety of reasons. There is no one in your audience who has ever been in the military, even if you weren't a tanker, who would go to war sitting over one ton of batteries. No one would do that in their right mind. It's foolish. And by the way, when I fill up the JP5 in my M1 Abrams, and I'm not a tanker, by the way, they would pass me on my ruck marches. But when I fill that up, it could take 10, 15 minutes. Charging a battery? I'm not the expert. 12 to 24 hours, maybe. Maybe a fast charger is shorter than that. But you're not recharging those in a combat effective time frame in which things are going very fast. You know, you and I both know.
Combat idle.
Go ahead.
Combat idle in an M1 is 48 hours, depending on what you're doing. And you have to, so the way it's been done for years is they back up the fuelers to the tank and then unload fuel while they're doing, they call it, you know, combat fueling, and they have a whole system for that, right?
Yeah.
But your 48 hours is what your combat range really is when you're in high intensity ops. And would we use that right now? Probably. Yeah, it's very doubtful. But you're right. That changes, the game's changed in the sense that you're not going to be doing, I mean, think about it this way. Fueling ops right now, if you had a bunch of tanks lined up, that's just a missile. That's a missile magnet, or it's a drone magnet more than anything else. So these big supply lines where they have these circular, where they stop, they get fuel, then they get food, then they get medical, then they get, you know, parts, whatever, and then they go back to the field. Those days are over. Let's just face it. Those days are over.
Yeah. I wanted to touch on one last thing because I know we want to talk about Storming America, where I talk about an upsized Gaza strike in the United States. And for those interested in more of my bloviations about this, episodes 1 through 12 of War Notes, I have a series called Fixing Fight Club, which was my modest proposal to unscrew what the Pentagon and the U.S. and the Western Marshall complexes have done to position themselves left of bang in a very unenviable position to win any war in the 21st century. Now, I realize that the U.S. has a pristine and sterling record of defeat and stalemate since 1945. And what I'm urging them to do is not only stay out of fights if they can, not only take a knee and be a regional hegemon and take a breath and reassess, not only to prioritize defense over offense, but if we don't fix this house of cards that is the Pentagon, they will lose the next big fight. There's no doubt in my mind that that's going to happen.
I don't disagree with that. We may not lose, but we'll be teetering dangerously on the edge until we get our shit together like we did in World War II, right? We were woefully unprepared in World War II, and the variety of reasons for that. I wanted to come back to a couple of things because this bears mentioning. Because we've referenced this tacitly throughout this show. We're talking about readiness, right? I want to say it was 2017 or 2018. Maybe it was earlier than that. There was a massive scandal in the Space Force, missile operations community way back when. And so it's been almost 10 years now. I should ask my buddy that's still in the system. But there was a cheating scandal that was going on. Plus, they were smoking pot in the capsules. They were doing all kinds of stuff. And the Air Force, the wing commander, I believe it was Malmstrom, was relieved of command along with the Secretary of the Air Force and a few others were all essentially drummed out of office. And I think it was before Trump. I think it was still Obama. So it had to be 2014 or 2015 when all this took place. So I could be wrong. I'll go dig it up. But the part that people don't realize is this readiness issue has been going on for a very long time. It's not a new issue. And to do maneuver to do maneuver warfare, it takes an incredible amount of training and synchronization to do that just in a normal combat arms unit, brigade, division. It takes an incredible amount of training. When you're talking about the ICBM forces, when SAC was still Strategic Air Command, they used to do what was called a readiness inspection, where they'd bring out an entire team from Offutt Air Force Base, and they would evaluate the entire wing, the maintainers, the mechanics, the leadership, the command centers, all the launch control centers. They were under scrutiny. They'd be out there for 30 days. And it was a big deal if you busted that. Like, people's careers literally went up in smoke when there was deviations, because it was a zero defect mentality.
Yeah.
And we've gone so far away from that now. And, you know, it's part of the politically correct side, the DEI side, but mainly it started with political correctness that changed that mindset away. Look, there's a certain amount of toxic masculinity that is a really good thing when you're talking about lethality. And unfortunately, there's byproducts and there's second and third order effects to that. But we're in a space now where we're at a culmination point where if we don't reverse the course and start preparing for the next war, and I'm not even talking about the vaccine injuries and all the other shit that's been pushed upon the population that we have to deal with. I'm just talking about readiness. We're in such a bad state right now that it would take us two to three years at least to get our shit together, even if we had the manufacturing. And we don't have the manufacturing to replace half the stuff that we've sent to Ukraine. That's the part that people don't get. And then when you couple that with the lack of readiness and the lack of training, the lack of lethality, people don't realize how vulnerable we are, which is why guys like Bill and I are talking about this right now. And look, I know there's guys in the system that will vehemently disagree with me, but the truth of the matter is they know something's wrong too. I don't live with my head in the sand. I'm looking at the what's so. We're not prepared to fight a multi-regional war, which is what we trained to do by doctrine for almost 50 years. We could barely fight one conflict right now for longer than a week. Or as Bracken would say, we'd get a 1 week long orgasm and then we'd have to roll up the streets. And I agree with that.
So I want to make mention of two things before we move to storming America. CSBA did a report almost over 18 months ago where they estimated, with everything that we've given to the Ukraine, how long will it take us to replenish our Stingers? Now, there's a twofold problem with our Stingers. For the longest time, especially with the RMP in the 90s, which could service aerial targets at 360 degrees instead of having to aim at the pipe. Extraordinary way to take aircraft down. But we haven't paid attention to it. The system became moribund in 2003. Then all of a sudden, the Army becomes interested in 2018 and 2019. And then we give a whole bunch of these. I mean, we just empty entire pallets and lots out of ASPs to the Ukraine. Guess how much how many years they estimate it would take, according to that CSBA report, to replenish all the Stingers back to the inventory they had before the Ukraine war? 18 years.
Yeah, I was going to say 20.
18 years. Now I think because of rare earth element availability that it may be longer than that. But by extension, here's the biggest problem in my mind. I was aghast and just absolutely, I was crestfallen when I saw sending all of these exquisite platforms from Patriot to THAADS. You name the missile system that we had in our IAMD inventory. Not to mention tanks such as Leopards, Chieftains, and Abrams, to Ukraine, because whatever you may think about the Russians are students of war for various reasons. They pay attention, they take notes, and they're chess players. So here they had this golden opportunity to look at everything that we had deployed over there and find ways to obviate it, get inside its OTA loop and neutralize it, or destroy it. F-16s, there was a twofer when we sent the F-16s over there where one of the Ukrainian patriots struck a Ukrainian F-16. So it was a two-for-one for the military-industrial complex in D.C. But every tank that went in the eastern third of the country was turned into scrap in 72 hours, mostly by FPVs and other things. But they're taking notes on this. And as I mentioned, when you look at the Russian strike reconnaissance complex, and I recommend my colleague Les Grau, who works at the FMSO, the Foreign Military Studies Office. He did a 2018, we could put this in the show notes if you want. He did a 2018 review of the Russian strike reconnaissance complex. And I gave a talk on this past summer when I went to a professional organization annual symposium where I talked about this very thing. What we've allowed them to do is take our IAMD, which they had the slightest intimation of how it worked, and observe it in real time and find ways to neutralize it, find ways to get around it. And I think that we are in a worse place now as a result of our largesse to the Ukraine, because we've given our potential peer enemy, in this case Russia, not China, this golden opportunity to be in a war laboratory where in real time, in near real time, they can learn how to defeat these systems. Have you noticed, for instance, that I'm a big fan of the A-10. As a matter of fact, I saw A-10s in action when I was in Afghanistan. And in one instance, I was very grateful that they were there. A-10s will not survive in a peer conflict in the 21st century. A-10s, I hate to say this, it hurts my heart, they need to go away because they're done. They're anachronisms. Did you notice that the Su-25 Frogfoot, which was the Russian variant of the A-10 in their own peculiar architecture, they can't send them past the eastern third of the Ukraine, because if they do, they lose them. They lose them to missiles, because missiles, and I know it sounds like we're hammering our feet on the floor, Steve and I, we are, but missiles have changed the game entirely for 21st century warfare. And if you don't pay attention to it, you're just going to lose.
Something I think that's, and we'll get to the attack next. Something I think it's worth mentioning and talking about, because you know we're still fighting that big kinetic war on the ground and the fold a gap. That's what the A-10 was designed to do, right? It was designed for close air support and the fold a gap to fight the big Russian horde, right? And you're right. We've sent a host of stockpiles. Almost all of our strategic reserve has gone to Ukraine. And the piece that I think is we're not discussing is, I think it was done on purpose, because Biden was compromised by China. Obama was compromised by China. There's a lot of people in Washington, D.C. that are compromised by China. China benefits if we're in a weakened state. If we send all our strategic stockpiles overseas, just destroyed, and they know that we can't replenish those, it gives them free rein in the South China Sea to do whatever they want to do, and they know they're going to be unopposed. If they know we haven't modernized our ships, which I think is a big part of their plan, because remember, they're playing the long game. They're not playing the short game. We play the short game, and we suck at it. They play the long game, and they're good at it. Part of the long game for them is to weaken us over time. If they can weaken us by not modernizing our fleet, by not modernizing our forces. Because the one thing we didn't talk about is they took the peacekeepers offline. The peacekeeper was the replacement, or at least it was a stopgap between the Minuteman III and the next variant of the ICBM, which we never got to. We took Minuteman IIs out of the hole. We took PKs out of the hole. And for those of you who don't know what a peacekeeper is, Peacekeeper was an initiative that was started in the 80s by Ronald Reagan. And because of the START treaty, START 1 and START 2, we couldn't build new silos. So we had to use the holes that we had, and we had to make the missile that we were building fit in the hole. Well, the Peacekeeper had a bigger diameter than the Minuteman because it had more warheads. So what they did is they pushed it in there with compressed gas and with these spacers against the wall. And literally, they'd punch it out of the hole like if you put an M80 under a can underwater, it punches the can out of the water and then blows up. And that's essentially what a PK does, right? It would launch like a sub-based missile. And we had that in the hole for, 20, 30 years? And now we're in a place where the PKs are gone. All we have is Minuteman IIIs. We haven't replaced anything with any follow-on systems. We haven't modernized the Minuteman IIIs. I mean, we have a serious deficit in missile technology, not to mention we don't have the production capability to replace any of this stuff anytime soon. And that's why this is such a dangerous moment in U.S. history, because in World War II and prior to World War II, even after World War II, we had the production capability in the industry here to go from ground to combat. We can't do that anymore. And because the Chinese have been running around at the same time they were infiltrating us, infiltrating Europe, they've been running around the planet, buying all the strategic mineral rights around the globe, doing exactly what we did in the 50s, beating us at our own game. So we have a bigger systemic issue going on that we have to fix, other than just we need new shit. Sorry.
Well, you saw what happened in Niger, in Africa. And by the way, for those listening, I'm the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute. They have a blog, and 3 to 5 times a week, I blog about Pentagon mischief, follies, frailties, misfires, squibs, mistakes, and everything. And there's a whole I know there's probably over 130 entries on the Pentagon follies. You will just be amazed at how awful everything is, and the way we simply can't get anything right. What you're describing about the peacekeepers, and now we have the Minuteman III in the silos, we need to get rid of those. Like, I ask myself, why do we have nuclear gravity bombs for our bomber fleet? Does anyone realize what's going to happen to B-52s? Now, nuclear-tipped cruise missiles make sense to me, but is there anybody listening who wants to be a pilot in a B-52? And don't worry about being a pilot for a bone, which is the B-1B, because you'll never leave the United States, or even in a B-21 or whatever the case may be. Do you really want to lob a nuclear gravity bomb? It makes no sense to me. Nor do the fixed silos make any sense to me, because of the lower cost production of fleets of missiles that can be sent against them. And as far as I know, Stephen, tell me if I'm wrong in this, what kind of material IAMD is there around all the land-based silos?
I can't tell you that.
Yeah. Maybe it's something that we can't discuss. Who knows? But yeah, my suspicion is it is not very robust. That.
Yeah, we can't discuss it, but suffice it to say, yeah, we can't discuss it.
Yeah.
I can give you a definitive maybe that said is true and it's there, but I can't tell you what it is.
But in a war of leakers, they will still, the U.S. will not prevail.
No, not right now.
Right.
I'm sure we've made, I want to give the folks that are in the Pentagon some of the benefit of the doubt for the drones, because I know they've been working on it since the conflict in Ukraine started. We still have a long ways to go. I'll just put it that way. And with the new wrinkle of the pager attack, it makes the game even more complex than it was at the start of the conflict.
And I think the Sentinel replacement for the Minuteman III is going to keep shifting to the right. It's going to keep getting more expensive, and they'll be lucky to replace them in the holes by 2040.
I don't think they will. I honestly don't think they will. I think they'll go to a mobile-based, you know, like, remember the rail system that they wanted to do in the 80s, the whole rail-based ICBM, and why it was scrapped, because, you know, it was too dangerous to put it on rails, but we could have moved missiles all over the U.S. and confused the Russians, but the technology at the time wasn't there. I see us moving to what Matt's been talking about, is container-based missiles and moving those all, because you could move those all over the country and nobody would know which ones were which.
Or you can put them underwater.
Yeah, that too. I mean,
in littoral
space. We already have that
with
subs. But yeah, you can put the containers underwater too and just park them there.
Yep. Should we discuss Storming America?
Yeah, let's talk about Storming America. Let's talk about the cartels and the attacks.
Let's
move to that.
So in my podcast, Chasing Ghosts, I did a Storming America series that is episodes 37, 41 through 43, and 49 through 50. I'm certain that Steve will be kind enough to put that in the show notes so that you can go there and see what you think. What I asked myself when I first published that is, what happened October 7th in Gaza in the attack on Israel, what if that were upsized and supersized in America? Which I consider to be not a matter of if, but when. And to make the math easy, I said that there would be 10,000 men in 1,000 cells in that one morning, let's say it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday morning, they all simultaneously attack. I based the ruminations not only on my sense of what would happen, but I also read two books, which I recommend to everybody, which is William Fortune's novella called Deus Irae, Day of Wrath, and then also Kurt Schlichter's book, The Attack. I recommend both of those. They're extraordinary. They come to different conclusions, but spoiler alert, I'm not going to tell you what those conclusions are. I'll let you read them for yourselves. Now, what they posit is very interesting. Fortune, for instance, says what's going to happen is they're going to hit elementary schools, and then they're going to have secondary teams, and they're going to do this all at the same time, by the way. Then they're going to have secondary teams that will be waiting on arterials between residential areas and those elementary schools so that they can hit the parents on their way in when the parents discover that their children are in the hazard in the most horrible ways at these elementary and middle schools. So that's how he posited how this would happen. What Schlichter said, again, very interesting. He said, on the first day, what they're going to do is they're going to hit common areas, shopping areas, malls, things like that. Second day, they will hit residential areas. Third day, they will hit infrastructure. Now, mind you, I'm trying to make the math easy by saying 10,000 men spread across CONUS, maybe Alaska, maybe Hawaii, who knows how it would happen. But on that first day, that first 24 hours, they would target malls. They would target storefronts. They would target arterials. They would target maybe schools on that first day. The government, being the slow, shambling Leviathan it is, on the second day would secure all those areas and leave the residential areas free for the malefactors, the Islamist cells, to hit. Same thing would happen on the third day, where all law enforcement and military by this time is called up. They run to the residential areas and the malls to protect them, and then the strikes are made against infrastructure. Now, what makes Islamist cells especially pertinent to an attack like this is not only have we had a porous border, but given Kalashnikovs or whatever small arms they would adopt, grenades, incendiary devices, explosive devices, those could be V-beds that they have built into vehicles, all this stuff can be in place right now as we speak. All of this can clack off tomorrow morning. And this is a fire and forget mission. You won't have captains or colonels or generals who are going to be staffing and directing these 10-man cells all around. They have very simple instructions. Go out until you're injured and can't do it anymore, or die. That's your job. If you last 72 hours, great. If you last 24 hours, great. But you must commit mischief, mayhem, and murder and killing and rapine, things that you would do. This will murder, this will kill tens of thousands of Americans. It will maim and kill, it will maim and injure hundreds of thousands of Americans. Now, I'm hoping I'm not being too
conservative. Let me ask you a question.
Those numbers. Go ahead, Steve.
Let me ask you a question, because I think there's a, I'll bring you back a little bit. So first of all, you believe there's going to be an attack at that scale on our soil this year or next year?
I can't say this year, but I think there will be an attack of this scale sometime. I learned that as an intelligence guy, I know the distinction between prediction and forecast. You'll never hear me predict, but I will forecast, because the evidentiary basis for prediction makes me look like a goober if I get it wrong, but I can forecast.
I've been wildly along trying to predict and forecast stuff, so I got out of that business last year. I was wildly wrong. But one thing I want to say, though, before you go down this road, is that I want to remind everybody that we're operating from the perspective that these groups were decentralized. They don't communicate. They were issued instructions. They were trained all over the past 4 years, and they were funded up until 10 days ago. So that means they still have reserve funds, et cetera, to keep these forces in the field here on our soil. And potentially they could kick things off in the next couple of weeks. Trump might have accidentally set the tripwire. We don't know. But we know these forces are here. He's rolling up the worst of the worst of the cartels and the jails that have been emptied into our society, but That's the cells they know about. And we have a host of other decentralized, already trained, well-equipped, provisioned troops that are still, they're still infiltrating, they're still infiltrating and still collecting. So go ahead, continue. That's, I want to put that out there so everybody knew exactly what we're talking about.
So I'm looking at some of the comments while you were speaking, Stephen, and there's some good stuff in here. Like somebody says, like the Tet Offensive, because let's remember that the Tet Offensive in Hue in 1968 in Vietnam, that was a tactical failure for the North Vietnamese, but a strategic win in so many ways. And this will be the same thing. And then Open Observatory is asking me something interesting here. And I apologize to the audience, by the way, that I haven't been paying attention to all or any of these questions, but I saw this one pop up. And he says, why wouldn't we just use the same tools that caused the control burns like they did in Palisades? I'm with you. I'm a former wildland firefighter for a period of time, and I've done wildland fire and urban interfaces and such. And the degree to which you could burn down parts of a state like California because of various politically correct and scientifically illiterate forestry practices, I have no doubt in my mind that that would be an ancillary campaign. Because one thing that Schlichter talks about, since we're talking about ancillary and auxiliary campaigns, and this just chills my blood, is he said that there will be a lot of volunteers, as it were, casual or some planned, among college students who happen to be on the Palestinian bandwagon, who will be alerted to provide auxiliary services, maybe to clog up 911 lines, maybe to target first responders. And someone mentioned that in the chat. And I do think that targeting of first responders will be part of this campaign if it does occur. So
yeah, we've talked about that in the roundtable several times.
Yeah. Now, and then others have said, well, what's going to happen as far as Chinese sleepers? Will Iranian sleepers and such be activated? I really have no idea how that would pan out, but I think the damage done simply by the Islamist cells would be huge. And now let's slip into, since we're running out of time a little bit, I just finished my latest Chasing Ghost podcast on why sending soft and tier one hitters after the cartels may not be such a good idea, as sexy and masculine as it sounds. What's going to happen, number one, if these Islamist cells that have a very close relationship with the cartels because of human trafficking and providing the rat lines and arterials and coyotes to get them into the country if they don't come legally to do so. So there's already a relationship there that they have. It is my position that if we send our soft guys, and I was a soft herbivore, not a carnivore, but I supported, I was the military intelligence detachment commander and the S2 SIO at first Special Forces Group, worked with the SIF organization there and did tips and things like that. So I'm very conversant in the way they work. I am not conversant in behind the green fence and how Tier 1 and CAG works. I know as a layman what they can do. Their assaulter skills, second to none, some of the best shooters on earth. These are low-density billets. There's not a lot of these guys. Even if you take Special Tactics Squadron 24 from the Air Force, even if you take MARSOC, even if you take SEAL Team 6, when they're not on a publishing tour and a promotion tour. When you take all these guys and combine them together, the one-third rule kicks in. And I don't want to bandy about numbers, but I think that sending soft organizations into Mexico after cartels to do liquidations or surgical removals via trigger presses, I think the second and third order effects of that are going to be horrendous. Not only are there 50 to 60 people queuing up behind every cartel leader to take over that very lucrative trade in drugs, human trafficking, and all the rest, but the Sicarios, and I just watched Sicario and Sicario Soldado again the other day.
Great movie. Great movie.
I'm a big fan of Mike Vining and seeing his, it wasn't him, but it was a cameo appearance, as it were. I mean,
Emily Blunt was the worst person to play for that role, but that's still a very, very good depiction of how that game's played.
But the ruthlessness of the cartels and their underground economy and how they behave is such that nothing is off the table as far as targeting. And I don't want this to happen. As a matter of fact, everything I've said to you guys in the last 15 minutes, I want to be proven wrong, where you guys will say, well, Bill, that didn't happen. And I will be thankful that that's the case. What will happen is the intelligence network and the intelligence feeds that the cartels get are probably some of the most sophisticated in the world, not to mention the casual observation systems and communities of intelligence they have in every major city in the United States. They will be able to find who the families of the tier one shooters are, or the tier one shooter support organizations, or politicians who just so happen to stand up and say, maybe we should do this. As a matter of fact, I would urge all of my listeners on here, take a look at how many politicians vying for political office or the presidency in Mexico in the past 20 years have been liquidated. It'll be shocking when you see the numbers. So the bottom line is, I think that going after the cartels could also be a predicate for waking up those cells for this Islamist attack.
I agree. And it, like I said, it could be the tripwire that Trump he inadvertently pulled. He didn't realize he pulled. And, you know, it could activate a cascading series of events that most people aren't even paying attention to.
Vedic Warrior says the cartels specialize in savagery. I agree 100%, sir. And we are going to see things that we'll never want to see again if this happens. I think it is so ill-advised, because this whole thing of thinking that we could shoot our way out of this problem, because what does shooting our way into the cartels and eliminate the leaders do about tamping down the demand signal for the products in the first place?
It's just nothing. Whack-a-mole. That's all it is, just whack-a-mole.
Yep.
You spend all your time taking out the next leader. But really, the power in all of it is going to be the economic warfare waged against Mexico, right, and China, because really that's where the pain is going to come in, right? But, you know, heaven forbid that we don't have avocados that come out of Mexico. But I want to remind everybody, imagine avocados laced with fentanyl as a part of this conflict, or, you know, some kind of a product, even Topo Chico that comes out of Mexico. Imagine that laced with fentanyl. And with the damage that would do before people even knew what was going on and where it was coming from. So there's a number of attack surfaces that have opened up beyond just the kinetic stuff. The kinetic stuff is the stuff we're going to see graphically in the news that they're going to play over and over and over to galvanize the American public to do some kind of a, you know, kinetic invasion of Mexico. But the stuff that you're not really thinking about is, think about the damage that they could cause by lacing products with different chemicals that would slowly kill people over time, cause cancer, et cetera. So that's the kind of stuff the cartels are good at as well, that most people don't even think about. They are great at assassination. They've perfected it over the years. And it's not a smash and grab where they knock the door down, walk in with a 45 and blast people. It doesn't work that way. They will find insidious ways to kill people, and then they will film it to let you know they killed you.
Oh, they will film it. There's no doubt, because those in your audience who are Afghanistan or Iraq veterans like myself, the Mujahideen or the Taliban or Al-Qaeda or ISIS, any number of these organized resistance organizations, for them, and this speaks to what you specialize in, Steve, when it came to narrative shaping and videography, second to none. Yeah. No one could do it better. When it came to Arabic language narrative shaping and legitimacy shaping than what they did, they would never launch a VBED or an IED or anything like that without having video coverage of it, so that they could bring it back to the editing room and, you know, make it fancy and do whatever they had to do to render it so that it would become a order of magnification increase for the cause that they champion. Now, there's a wild card in all of this, and I don't think the wild card is enough to ameliorate the savagery or what's going to happen on this day of wrath. But, and I know especially in this audience, this is sort of like handpicking the audience that would do this very thing. I carry a gun everywhere I go. I have one near me. So, and I know that many members of your audience are the same. That is the wild card for this attack, because there is such a distributed and high density unknown characterization of weapons that people have either on their person or rifles in the vehicle. For instance, if this strike were to occur in England, no one would be able to do a thing. But this is also going to put a question in the minds of these cells on how long are we going to last once the civilians' guns come out and start capping people. So
I don't think we're too far away from that.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be some kind of a event this year. And not sure I agree with Sarah Adams' predictive programming that there's going to be this mass attack in Europe, then the mass attack here. But if we follow that logic, that was the game plan that they were going to use against us. All that
I think
said,
she works for a three-letter agency.
Of course she does. Of course she does.
She does.
They were telling us what the Dirty Tricks crew was going to do to the U.S. I don't know if the funding being cut affects that Dirty Tricks squad, but let's assume that for all things being equal, that it does. And they're hamstrung, or at least restricted in their abilities, but they could still conduct attacks. I still think there's going to be some kind of an attack. Maybe it's, and I don't get the whole fascination with schools, why they always go after schools, but hey, it is what it is, right?
So, are you asking why they would go after schools?
No, I don't get the fascination with it. When there's other venues they could go after, they'll be way more effective, create way more chaos, and paralyze the entire nation.
I have no doubt that infrastructure is the problem with hitting infrastructure, though, as much as that would lay America low, is that it doesn't have the sexiness or savagery that attacking an elementary or middle school would do, and the sheer panic that would cause. Because remember, the more panic that is caused by an attack like this, the harder the response is going to be by the government, whether it's police or military or emergency services, whatever the case may be, the greater the chaos, the more hampered they'll be in achieving what they have to do.
That's true. I mean, all that's true. I just, like I said, I don't get the fascination with schools when you could do the same thing at a mall. Have you been to a mall lately? I mean,
no, I don't go to malls.
It's like a smorgasbord of stupid that, you know.
Old Remus told me to avoid crowds.
I've been doing that for, we've been doing that instinctively for a couple of years now, right? Yeah.
Yep.
So, but to a bulk of the population that gets their news from Instagram, they are not paying attention. So, the part that I think is a gap here is the initial attack. Let's say they do a widespread attack across the country and they don't initially hit infrastructure. They let the news get out, then they hit the infrastructure, and then they start to take down different parts of the country. That would create a significant amount of chaos.
Yeah.
And they could inflict a tremendous amount of casualties if they take the power out and they take the ability for people to communicate out. They could just basically walk through neighborhoods. How many people do you know are completely unarmed? I mean, there's a lot of recipes there is what I'm trying to say.
None of my friends or acquaintances are unarmed, just like I don't have communist friends or acquaintances.
Yeah, but we're the exception. We're not the rule. The exception is the fact that we're all carrying heavy. The rule is most people are unarmed. And most people that do conceal carry shoot their concealed carry maybe once a quarter. Maybe.
Yeah.
The real, the guys like, Chris from Combat Studies, Joe Dolio, those guys that are training, those guys are doing it all the time. But they're the exception. And, you could, like I said, you create enough chaos in the right order and you can affect a tremendous sum of casualties, because very quickly in a situation like that, the first responders will still be investigating the first crime while you're perpetrating the second, third, fourth, and fifth. And if you don't target them, they're still going to be overwhelmed within the first 2 hours of a major event. And they're going to be mired with their own problems trying to get situational awareness for at least 2 to 3 hours. And assuming they do get SA, which I doubt, then you're talking about how do they respond? They're going to have to spend 24 hours just trying to figure out how to respond. Think about how many casualties you can cause in that period of time while they're absolutely still trying to get their pants on.
We're totally unprepared. Absolutely unprepared. And you know, you mentioned situational awareness. It is situational understanding that is going to be the key to living through this.
Agree.
And your battle drills, of course. You need your unconscious competence.
Yeah, and lethality. You can't hesitate.
Yep.
And assume that there's going to be fratricide if this comes to pass. I would hope for our part, nothing happens. All these guys decide to just go home and they figure out it's too costly. I don't see, and to address the Chinese, I don't see the Chinese doing force on force kinetic. That doesn't benefit their long-term objectives. I see them doing hit and run strikes on infrastructure. I see them hitting communications, but I don't see them doing direct engagement with U.S. forces unless they have an overall strategic objective that they need to meet by doing that. I don't see that benefiting them.
I take it a step further, and I know I'm in the extreme one-digit minority when it comes to this. The Chinese aren't at war with us in a hard way. They're in a soft war with us, but they're not in a hard war. The Chinese have zero historical, extraterritorial, military expeditions that have been successful. None. They don't have a blue water navy. They don't have any of that. They are a littoral navy. And somebody said the other day, well, they're building aircraft carriers. And like Napoleon said, and I'm paraphrasing, don't stop somebody when they're making mistakes. You know, if they want to dump blood and treasure into making those future fish apartments, good for them. I don't think the Chinese are our enemy, and I don't think that the Russians are our enemy. I do think there are Middle Eastern countries, both Shia and Sunni, who are committed to laying us low in America. And that is the number one threat in my mind. And I, as a matter of fact, I would go so far, and Schlichter does this in a way, hopefully this isn't much of a spoiler, in which he says that one of the Chinese sleeper cells in his book comes to the aid of Americans when they're assaulted by Islamists. The Chinese can't survive without the United States. They don't have the strategic sea lift nor airlift to get bodies of troops to establish a beachhead and a lodgment and expand from that and survive. They don't have it. That's not their style. And this whole notion that the first, second, and third island chains that the Chinese have, that's their business. They're regional hegemons. So if I can, I think we're coming to the end of this. I want to say a couple things, if I may, Steve, and that's this. Number one, America's defense, America's Pentagon, its U.S. military forces, I want them to take a knee, reassess, and concentrate on defending the country. Take that second D in the name, Department of Defense, and be honest about what you're doing and commit yourself to defending America, not all of these offensive operations planet-wide in these conflicts that we inevitably end in stalemate or defeat. And the second thing is that if we become regional hegemons and we start fixing what is awry and wrong with us as a country, instead of spending our unborn children and grandchildren's wealth and treasure on all of these Pyrrhic victories and tilting at windmills where we spend these trillions of dollars and it ends in nothing of benefit for the American people. So those are the two things I would want to leave everybody with, besides the fact that we just talked about this possible attack. So have your head on a swivel. But number two, I run the Chasing Ghosts podcast, just published episode 58, where I talk about the cartels and why I think it is ill thought out to go after them with soft, much less military forces. And also, I didn't mention this, and you had alluded to this, Steve. If you go to war against the cartels, you're going to war against Mexico. I don't think that will end well either. And I have War Notes, which is my conflict podcast, where I talk about conventional conflict. Just published 12 episodes on Fixing Fight Club, where I talk about the Department of Defense. I have a Substack. I'm on Twitter. And of course, I get to chat with worthies like yourself, Steve. So with that, there it is.
I will post all of the links to the books and to the podcast and all the ways to get a hold of Bill in the notes in the show. I'll be back tomorrow night with the round table. Bill, we got to do this again. We definitely have to figure out the tech of this so we can do a continuous show without the 10-minute.
My apologies to the audience for any kind of audio stuff happened. So
I will shamelessly remind you of that for the rest of your life. So no worries there.
That's fine because I own my mistakes.
Yeah, me too. All right.
Let me tell you, as a matter of fact, let me speak to that. When I commanded, I had a placard in my office that said, if you're operating at zero failure, you're an underperformer, to which I would always tell my men, I am an overachiever in that regard.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, folks, we'll be back tomorrow night. Thanks for the patience. Appreciate everybody sticking around while we figured out the technical issues. God bless everyone. One team, one fight.
Thanks.